Welcome to this Wednesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, Plainsfolk playing the German card in the Barossa as NDSU's Dr. Tom Easern traces surprising ties between North Dakota and South Australia. And later, Prairie Plates goes inside Harry's Steakhouse to hear how a Grand Forks tradition is making its mark now in West Fargo. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Glad you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. And in this week's episode of our regional news podcast, Prairie Beat, we update you on two ongoing stories, a homicide from last summer, and in the battle of who should have a data center, one community bows out.
Hey, I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We're back again for another episode of Prairie Beat,
our weekly news podcast here on Prairie Public. Danielle, what is in the news this week?
Well, this week I thought we could take a look back at a couple of stories we've already covered on the podcast and give some updates. There has been a lot going on.
Indeed, and I'm always game for a good follow-up. What is first?
So earlier this year, back in August, if you'll recall, there was a couple of weeks there where there was a lot of heat on the Fargo Police Department, specifically the chief of police, in response to a news conference after a particularly deadly night.
Yeah, you could maybe call this, if this were a TV show, in the heat of the night. I remember that night very, very well, and quite seriously and quite awfully. There were two fatal shootings that night. They are overshadowed by how Chief Cebulski handled speaking to reporters in the aftermath, all about the optics, all about the PR. These were some serious crimes. Two people dead and a couple of others injured, right?
Correct. This was the early morning of August 3rd. Elijah Hughes was shot and killed at an apartment building in Fargo, and three people were shot in downtown Fargo that same night. Two were injured, but Azeem Holmes was also unfortunately killed. And Fargo police were able to arrest Sandre Douglas the following day, charging him with the murder of Elijah Hughes, but they were still looking for the alleged shooter of Azeem Holmes. Fargo police said they were looking for Tyreek Jones, charged him with murder, and he wasn't located until last week.
Yeah, it was a very long stretch there, but they were pretty gleeful in the fact that they supposedly found the person that they were suspecting of this shooting. It was a very chaotic night for the whole Fargo-Moorhead area. Everybody was on edge for sure, and I think a lot of critique was a lack of kind of upfront communication about it. It wasn't until Monday that we even heard a whole lot from the Fargo Police Department, certainly the chief. There was a lot of confusion, not only about what happened, but questions about where he was at the time, about how safe Fargo is. Now Tyreek Jones, well, he has been on the run all this time, wanted for murder. They said he was armed and dangerous, too.
Yes, he was located in Minneapolis last week and then arrested. And obviously, you know, as we've been talking about, a lot can happen in 4 months. About a week after the shootings, Jones's mother released a letter to the public declaring his innocence. And once Fargo police were finally able to interview Jones down in Hennepin County last week, they actually determined that he was not the shooter they were looking for. Fargo police captain Matt Christensen said at a news conference on Friday, you need probable cause in order to charge with murder. But he said once they were able to interview Jones, things changed.
Well, the video is what we used to develop probable cause. And based on the information we got from him, we reevaluated the video. And based on his information from his actions, we're able to look at that video through a different lens and corroborate some of the information that he gave.
You know, and it should be said for those who think, well, why did he run if he had nothing to hide, if he was innocent? Well, that might be easy to say if you grew up not being afraid of police and authorities, as some individuals and historically some populations have. Plus, if you're being called armed and dangerous, it doesn't exactly make you want to emerge from hiding and say, here I am. Well, you know, in rewinding, that's really something, because they said initially that video evidence led to the murder charge, right? Video evidence doesn't lie, supposedly. I feel like this isn't the sort of thing that you hear about very often in these types of cases. So what did he say in that interview?
So they're not really quite willing to say exactly what he said. At the news conference, they said, you know, this is an open investigation, and I understand that, you know, while it's going on, they like to keep certain details to themselves as the investigation works itself out. But court documents have painted a bit more of a detailed picture, even if that picture seems to just pose more questions, honestly. Tyreek Jones was actually hanging out and playing video games with Elijah Hughes. That's the other murder victim that night at the apartment building where Hughes was allegedly shot by Sandre Douglas. Jones was interviewed by police that very night. He told them that Hughes got a text message, left, and then he was shot outside the apartment. And when he was interviewed, Jones told police he assumed Hughes had left to go home, but they noticed he did have a couple of noticeable injuries to his face that he said was a work-related injury. And Jones was later observed on surveillance video downtown Fargo being struck on the head by Azeem Holmes. Now, that's the victim Jones was accused of shooting. He was hit in the head with a glass bottle. Jones chased Holmes, and someone is seen on the video with a pistol, and multiple shots are seen fired.
Okay, so that was the video police said seemed to implicate Holmes in the first place. That's quite the sequence of events, and you're right. It really does raise more questions about how all these people knew each other and what really happened, how it's all connected, tied together. I don't think that we're going to know much until authorities arrest the alleged right person.
That's what they're working on right now. Fargo police are asking the public again to come forward if they have any tips or information.
I regret that this is how it played out. But like I said, at the time of the investigation, based on the information we had, we did have probable cause to make that arrest and identify him as a suspect. It would have been really nice to interview him right away. We could have cleared that up 4 months ago, and we'd be 4 months ahead.
Now, Tyreek Jones' mother, Shannon Jackson, she once again spoke to the media last week, and she says just because of everything that's happened, her son's life has been in danger and is in danger. He's being extradited to Cass County on a couple of other unrelated warrants. So, again, this is a continually developing story with a lot of moving parts.
Well, I guess we will just have to stay tuned to that. I know you guys will be on top of it. So, were there any other follow-ups this week, Danielle?
Yeah, so we reported this fall on the Applied Digital Data Center that was proposed for just outside of Harwood, which is north of Fargo. That project was very quickly approved, but there was a bit of a turf war about that project that ended up being settled just this week.
Applied Digital talked to both Fargo and Harwood about where they wanted to build this thing, and they picked Harwood. That had to do with some city franchise fees that they didn't want to pay in Fargo, go figure. Mm-hmm. But then Fargo started proceedings to annex the Harwood land into their city limits as the North Dakota world turns.
Yes. And yeah, this was a very testy situation between the two cities. Data centers, like we've been saying, you know, they can be kind of controversial in the first place. So the cities were kind of looking at, you know, do we want to take on this project that will have infrastructure and resource impacts on our community? Is it worth the risk to get that reward, all that stuff? City leadership in Harwood seemed agreeable to taking on the project and all the responsibilities of it. But Fargo had some budget issues this year, if you recall, and probably saw a good opportunity there. It's a $3 billion facility. But this week, the city of Fargo officially pulled their annexation proposals. So that matter is pretty much settled for now.
Well, that has been quite the story, with leadership from both cities having very passionate feelings about the whole thing. I sense a little trepidation on the part of residents of both cities, too. If there are any benefits to data centers, then cities want to receive those benefits, naturally. But I've read a lot about other data centers everywhere else in the country, and they're sprouting up like weeds, where electric rates are an issue. I know they use a lot of water, too. That's another big issue, mm-hmm. to keep the buildings cool. That's one advantage that North Dakota has. Emotions certainly ran high, but at least for now, it seems a matter of which city will host that center has been settled. More questions and impacts are likely to come, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so we're going to have to see about that, huh? The territory is settled, but more than likely more to come from that story.
So you news people, what else have you been working on this week?
It wasn't a good fit for the rural and frontier areas of North Dakota.
North Dakota's long-term care association says a burdensome regulation they were working to be in compliance with has been removed.
The point of the grant is to support the educators.
The Department of Public Instruction has received a grant to help focus on math education. And as I'm sure everyone has noticed, we've been having winter weather this week here in North Dakota. Folks should definitely take care if they are manually moving snow from their sidewalks and driveways.
We probably all know heart attacks seem to go up this time of year when people are trying to shovel that snow. So, you know, take it easy out there, will you? All right, Danielle, thank you for all that good info.
You bet. Be sure to tune in to Prairie Public for more news or check us out online at news.prairiepublic.org.
All right, that's all, folks, for this week's Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Dethridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
You can find episodes of our weekly regional news podcast, Prairie Beat, at prairiepublic.org or wherever you like to get your podcasts.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Health Partners, offering a simplified approach to health plans, customer service, and community partnerships in North Dakota. Learn more at healthpartners.com/Dakota Plans.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today on Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Easern takes us halfway around the world to the Barossa region of South Australia, where German-speaking Lutherans carved out a community in the 1840s that still bears the imprint of their old-world faith and frontier grit. Standing in the Bethany Church, Tom considers the bonds of shaped heritage, the missionary endeavors that carried Barossa Lutherans into the Australian outback, and the complicated history those efforts left behind. It's a story of kinship, archives, and the questions that come when we look at honesty at the past.
It was a lovely spring morning when we arrived for Sunday services at Bethany Church in Toonunda, South Australia, in the heart of the Barossa region. I inquired after the congregational president, who was up in the loft, preparing to ring the bells. After introducing myself and being welcomed, I did what a Missouri Synod Lutheran would do in this situation. I requested permission to attend communion with the members, to which my host readily acceded. I know to many of you, the closed communion thing seems a bit much, but it's still the way with conservative German Lutherans. There was a reason beyond the doctrinal or spiritual for my inquiry. I wanted to acknowledge and make it known that despite the thousands of blue Pacific miles separating our homes, we were kin. I have no ancestors, none, who were not evangelical Lutherans from the province of Hanover. The German-speaking colonists of South Australia in the 1840s were similar folk from Silesia, Prussia, with the missionary leavening from a seminary in Hanover. At one time, in fact, despite distance, the people at Bethany in the Barossa were adherents of my own Missouri Synod in America. I wanted our new friends to know that I know how things are done. I guess I was playing the Lutheran card, but I'm confessing it now, so I think we're good, right? The Silesians commenced arrival in South Australia under the leadership of Reverend August Ludwig Christian Kavel. We visited his grave at the Long Mile Cemetery in Toonunda a few days ago. We also, at the Old Bethany Cemetery, stood at the gravesite of Friedrich Topp, 44 years the schoolmaster at Bethany School, organist at the church. I've been reading his mail at the Australian Lutheran Archives in Adelaide. His handwriting, I would describe it as prim and oh so tiny. I photographed pages to blow up on screen for translation. Another greater point of interest. In front of the Bethany Church is a modest monument commemorating the departure in 1875 of a missionary expedition led by Georg Adam Heidenreich, who had been sent out from the Hermannsburg Missionary Seminary in Hanover. We visited his grave, too. Bethany was the home base of the Lutheran Party, who drove 2,200 sheep overland into the heart of the Australian desert to found an agricultural mission to the Arrernte people at Intaria on the Fink River. The mission persists and boasts a world-famous Aboriginal women's choir. The agriculture, that didn't do so well. There are questions now, too, in the 21st century about the educational and cultural initiatives of the missionaries at Fink River. Schoolmaster Topp, who we know, at Bethany, applied the cane so vigorously that there is a ballad about him. Corporal punishment at the Fink River Mission is a critical question among historians of the enterprise. Much of the discussion resonates with that around American Indian boarding schools here on our side. There has been quite a bit written about the Lutheran missionaries and the Arrernte people at Fink River, but we are determined to look into the matter historically. By we, I mean me and Dr. Kelly, my collaborator in all Australasian research. What can we bring to the discussion that able Australian historians have not already done? First, at the heart of the Fink River Initiative was agriculture, the attempt to establish model farms and a model agricultural community. That pretty much failed. And how could it have succeeded when it was directed by missionaries from Hanover, inexperienced in anything like this desert country? On the other hand, my family has 150 years of mostly successful farming experience in a semi-arid land. And I am an agricultural historian. I think I can bring some expertise to the post-mortem on Lutheran agriculture at Fink River. Dr. Kelly, further, is a former elementary teacher with solid academic training in human development. She is the one to investigate and reflect upon what went right or wrong in the educational and child-rearing aspects of the mission. We both know our way around archives and are familiar doing field work far from home. I should look around and see if I can find my mother's membership papers in the LWML, the Lutheran Women's Missionary Society, just in case.
You've been listening to Plains Folk, written and voiced by historian Dr. Tom Easern from North Dakota State University, where he is a distinguished professor of history. His reflections connect the prairie world with the wider one and remind us that the stories we inherit often require fresh eyes and deeper digging.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. As climate change threatens subsistence in the Arctic, one village in Alaska is trying to transform reindeer herding practices into a sustainable business. The Alaska Desk's Ayolna Niden has more from Savunga.
And a bumpy, huh?
Richmond Tooley rides his four-wheeler across the wet tundra outside of Savunga. The mountains of black volcanic rock glisten behind him in the September sun, and the Bering Sea in front. Tooley is a third-generation chief reindeer herder. He pauses to spot the animals through his binoculars.
All summer there are reindeer out here.
St. Lawrence Island sits 100 miles west from mainland Alaska, with two villages on it, Savunga and Gamble. It's also home to several thousand free-range reindeer. In the late 1800s, famine struck the island, and the animals were introduced here as a food source. Today, the herd continues to support the island as warming conditions disrupt subsistence and storms can hold up food deliveries for weeks. Now, Savunga is building a reindeer meat processing facility. Tooley, like other Savunga residents, hunts various animals.
Whaling captain. Yeah. Whaling walrus. Seal. Reindeer. Bird. Fishing.
But Tooley says that hunting has been changing. The sea ice around the island sets up later and is less stable.
Back in 2012, both communities didn't get no walrus, so we gave all the households two reindeer each for both communities.
Larry Kava is a local elder who says he has noticed the difference in the environment over the years.
It really, really affects our hunting. Another thing is the climate change. The migration pattern is real different now. Like whales, the migration is about almost 2 months early or 2 months late.
Kava says having reindeer on the island helps.
That's really reliable. That's our delicacy now.
Each year, herders and hunters get permits and hunt reindeer for themselves and for others. The village also comes together to share reindeer meat during holidays. The village of Savunga is ramping up its food sovereignty efforts even further with a new facility that could transform processing of reindeer in the field and household kitchens into a small-scale industry. Once the facility opens, pre-portioned cuts of meat will be available for sale. Tooley, the chief herder, is excited.
Yeah, can't wait.
The shiny modular plant is next to the beach with a temporary corral by the entrance. Inside, there are several rooms for cooling and freezing meat. Freeman Kinnicook is the business director of the Savunga Reindeer Commercial Company, a subsidiary of the village that will manage the facility. He says the plan is to slaughter reindeer about four times a year and sell it locally. In the future, there might be a chance to distribute it to other Alaska villages as well.
For sure, I hope to sell it to the folks on the island. when we did those trial runs, we would sell on Facebook, and we couldn't keep up with the demand. So really, it's undecided who the market is, but I know there's a market for it.
Perry Idiganakpangoi is a subsistence hunter and one of the locals working on a project. He is rearranging the refrigeration blocks. Pangoi says the new facility already brought a much-needed influx of jobs to the village and might open new economic opportunities.
It would be nice to have our stores selling our local reindeer, because it's hard to afford that steak. It's like $50-$60 for a piece of steak. And to me, reindeer tastes a lot better than steak.
Construction is scheduled to be completed in the coming weeks. Federal regulators plan to certify the plant for commercial use. With reporting from Savunga, I am Alona Naiden.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Plates goes inside Harry's Steakhouse to hear how a Grand Forks tradition is making its mark now in West Fargo. That's ahead, right after this.
I like bagels.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
You're listening to another edition of Prairie Plates, served weekly here on Main Street, here on Prairie Public. We have a very exciting guest here today, the opening of a new steakhouse in West Fargo. The one in Grand Forks is absolutely delicious. And so I invited Matt Wallowak to join us today to talk about the new Harry's Steakhouse in West Fargo. Matt, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Thanks for having me. You kind of oversold me a little bit, but you can oversell the restaurant. That's fine.
That's your job.
Yeah, yeah. Pleased to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Harry's Steakhouse in Grand Forks and the new location here in West Fargo.
So Harry's was my partner's dream. I guess to finish a family circle. His father had a restaurant in downtown Grand Forks that served steak, and he imported tenderloins from Chicago and was very proud of that. They had other things on the menu. I wish we were looking for a copy of the menu, but we don't have a copy. We just know for sure that there was tenderloins on the menu. That's kind of how this came to fruition. That evolved, and the chef left his father's restaurant, who was named Harry, and Harry decided to go a different route, and that's kind of how Happy Harry's was born. So that's a different branch of that tree. But so going back to the restaurant, Hal just had a dream of completing the circle and having a steakhouse in downtown Grand Forks again. And it was early, maybe the end of 2018, early 2019. We were on a board together, Hal and I, at the Alaris Center. And he asked me to come up to coffee. He wanted to run something by me. And so we met at, I forget the day. It was a local coffee shop up there, Urban Stampede, I think. And
classic.
Yeah, yeah. And he had this binder, three-ring binder with a bunch of pictures in it. And he was showing me these pictures, and it was plates of steak and some different decorations and kind of ambiance of what he was looking for. And he's like, I'm going to open up a steakhouse in downtown. And I kind of looked at him and I'm like, okay. And he goes, well, what do you think? And I said, well, I think it would go well. We don't have a steakhouse in Grand Forks, you know, like a true steakhouse after seeing these pictures. You know, we've got Texas Roadhouse and that's about it. But that's not really a traditional steakhouse.
it's good, but this is more of a big city steakhouse feel. Chicago,
yeah.
Minneapolis.
Yes, we were going for bigger, you know, more classic 1940s, 50s. Basically, you know, in Grand Forks, we had the Bronze Boot, but that closed down. But this would fill that void. So he's looking at this binder, and I told him, yeah, I think it'd be great. And he goes, well, excellent. He goes, you're going to run it. And I looked at him, and I was like, oh, okay. Because I own the Ground Round in Grand Forks, so I already had a restaurant that I was dealing with, and I was like, wow, how am I going to do this?
It's a lot of work, isn't it?
How are we going to do this? But that's kind of how it started, and we kept meeting, and then the end of 2019, right before COVID hit, Hal booked a trip to New York, and he said, we're going to go visit some steakhouses, some of my favorites in New York. Mm-hmm. I want you to get the full idea of what I want to do. And so we did that. We were out there for 4 days. He had a different place booked for lunch and dinner every day we were out there. So I learned real quick what the meat sweats were, and I think by the end of the trip, we were both ordering the seafood instead of steak. But it was a very surreal experience. It was very exciting. We took copious notes of what we thought worked well, what we thought would work in Grand Forks and what wouldn't. Everything from the plates, the silverware, to the linens, to the chairs, to lighting and temperature. We were very, very thorough, and he knew Kathy, his wife, is very particular about lighting, and a lot of restaurants have lighting that produces shadows over people, and women particularly don't necessarily like that. It's not a very lack of a word, but it doesn't show off the best features of ourselves or our faces, I guess, if we have shadows. So in the process, we brought in a lighting engineer, an acoustical engineer, and we think we did something good up there. It was 4 years in October now, 4 years we've been open. And the strange part is, what we didn't see coming is pretty much every night of the week, there was one table or multiple tables from the Fargo Market that had come up there specifically for dinner.
That would be me.
Yeah, that would be you. You'd be one of those? Okay.
Yes. I did go to UND. I did a lot of online classes, but I was up there sometimes. And, yep.
So we were kind of put back by that at first and confused. I mean, because there's obviously a plethora of restaurants here in Fargo. Excellent restaurants here in Fargo.
We don't have a true steakhouse either, and that's what this is.
That became very evident.
Yeah.
So a lot of people have asked, you know, what market research have we done in the Fargo market? And other than, visit some of these restaurants and have some food, our main market research was in Grand Forks with the amount of clientele from the Fargo market and surrounding areas. Even prior to our opening in Fargo, there was a couple that drove up from Sioux Falls, South Dakota, that had Googled, you know, good steakhouses in North Dakota, and we came up, and they drove specifically up to Grand Forks to celebrate their anniversary.
Wow.
Have dinner and stayed at the Olive Ann up there and went home.
Well, Harry's Steakhouse is a special place, and being to both now, they are similar in ambiance, but there are some differences. I think this one in West Fargo is a little larger.
We're about 75% larger.
Wow.
Grand Forks, if every seat is filled, would be 104. And then in West Fargo here, if every seat is filled, we're about 185.
Well, let's talk about the menu a little bit. I think it's the same menu, right?
Yep. We're running parallel.
And I was there not too long ago. I had a filet mignon, some of those thin onion rings, which I really love, Brussels sprouts, sherried mushrooms. I do need to try the hash browns.
You do.
Both varieties. Talk about those hash browns a little bit.
So the hash browns were kind of my baby. When we were in the planning process, I was explaining to Hal what I wanted to do with the hash browns, and he just would kind of look at me and be like, that's a lot of potatoes, are you sure? And I was very confident that being in our agricultural, you know, centered state, that the potatoes would be a hit.
Especially up by Grand Forks, yes. A lot of potato farms.
A lot of potatoes of farms up there, yeah. And we also serve, you know, most steakhouses, most restaurants in America serve russet baked potatoes. We serve Red River Valley Reds. That was very important to us to represent where we're from. And it makes a pretty good baked potato.
Well, let's talk about the steak a little bit because the beef is regionally sourced.
Yes. Yep. So we source our meat is processed in Nebraska, but they source the top 2% of the Hereford Baldy Angus beef that's raised in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. And it's been a great product. I mean, we've had many purveyors come in, even as you know, as far as Chicago, to have us try and test their beef, and we've done blind tastings, and nothing is compared to what we're serving. We're very pleased with it, and the feedback seems to be very positive from our guests.
Well, the next time I come in, I do love ribeyes. That's the best.
It's my favorite cut.
Yeah, just a lot of flavor.
A lot of flavor, and ours is really thick. It's a wow, and like you say, the flavor. You know, a lot of people like in New York, and they haven't tried ribeye for various reasons. Some say, "Oh, I heard it wasn't good for you," or whatever. But once they try the ribeye, they're like, "Wow, I've been missing out."
Well, I noticed the number to the West Fargo location is 701-757 beef.
You picked up on that.
There must be a reason why.
So I got that number in Grand Forks, too, and I was very particular about picking the number down here. I just thought it was clever.
It is, yeah.
Not that many people call anymore, but you do get phone calls, so.
Well, I might call you.
All right, just to dial the number. Yeah, okay.
Just to dial the number. Talk about some of the other classic steakhouse sides. I noticed French onion soup, cream spinach.
Yep.
There's a list of sides.
Yes, and so the cream spinach is interesting. You know, we sampled quite a bit of that in New York, and it's a classic, you know, staple in steakhouses. We added essence of jalapeno to ours just to jazz it up a little bit. Traditionally steakhouses kind of serve the same things, but we wanted to put our own twist on it just to make it our own. You know, and in that way, too, if something doesn't work, we can change it. But that went over pretty well when we tested it and rolled it out. But it's got your, you know, your staple spinach, obviously, and a lot of cream and a lot of cheese. And it has that little bit of, I'm not going to say heat, but you can taste it. We just use the essence, not the actual jalapeno or the seeds. But it's very good. And then the other popular green side would be our Brussels sprouts. We source from the Olive Barrel in Grand Forks. They make specialty olive oils and balsamic vinegars and different things. But we knew we wanted to use their products when we were opening, and we tried this special blend that they'd had, and it really brought out the flavor of the oil or the vinegar and the Brussels sprouts, and then you add the bacon and the cheese on there, and it's. It makes something that people don't like very much, you know, Brussels sprouts. Very good.
Yeah, they are good. I can attest to that. Well, for those pescatarians out there that might not eat beef, there's a seafood menu as well.
Yes. Yep. That was important to us to be able to provide products. We do get requests in Grand Forks, but I've noticed an overwhelming amount of inquiries in West Fargo about adhering to gluten-free diets and vegetarian diets, and we're very good. We can't guarantee 100%, you know, because there are glutinous items in our kitchen, but we do take precautions when preparing. We do have separate fryers. We have separate grilling areas, and we use separate fry pans for different dishes. But our servers are very trained to highlight those items that we need to take extra care with. But the portobello mushroom on our menu is very, very popular, and that can be made vegan, too, with eliminating the cheese that's on that. It's very good. I'm obviously a meat guy, but if I had to eat that as my dish, I wouldn't be too disappointed.
There are some vegetarians here at Prairie Public, and I've been talking you up. I've been saying there's stuff for you there too.
The salads are awesome, you know, and we can omit everything for that. You know, the bacon, that's pretty much the only thing on the salads that would be meat-wise. But and then all of our steaks can be made gluten-free. I mean, everything except for the pasta. We do have gluten-free bread available for both our hamburger and for dinner bread. And we go through quite a bit of that, and we're glad to be able to provide that.
Well, let's switch to beverages because I noticed the wall of whiskey. And I just had one glass of wine, but the wine and cocktail selection is extensive. And beer.
Yeah. We hired a mixologist in Grand Forks right away. Actually, he was the first – before we even posted – no, it was the day in Grand Forks that we posted on social media platforms that we were going to begin hiring. I think he was the absolute first application that came in, and Jacob is his name. And when we interviewed him, first thing out of his mouth was, when I saw you guys were building a restaurant, I knew I was going to work there. Like, okay, good, awesome. But he's been excellent working with the team in Grand Forks and then now with our team in Fargo with crafting these cocktails. And the names are pretty clever. And a lot of them are, you know, classic cocktails, but with our twist on them. But the barrel-aged old-fashioned would be our probably most popular cocktail. So we brought in oak barrels ourselves. So we mix this ahead of time, and it ages additionally in our barrels before we serve it. And then another popular thing we do is we can smoke that for people. And that's kind of cool because when we do that, the whole restaurant, you can kind of smell it, and it gets people curious. And
it's a smiles. Show.
Yeah, it is a show. So they deliver the smoke box to the table. So the guest sees the smoke, you know, engulfed in their cocktail, and then they open the door to take the cocktail out, and it's pretty cool.
And I've noticed it's those touches that really make Harry's Steakhouse what it is, not only with the food, the beverage, but the service is, like, paramount there, right?
The training's pretty extensive. I mean, opening in Grand Forks and Fargo, we hired servers off the street, so to say, but going forward now, to be a server at Harry's, you have to start at the bottom. You start out as a host, a server assistant, and a food runner. And that really is the start of your server training. There's a lot of details that go into training a server at Harry's, and we take pride in that because people do notice. It's the art of dining, I guess, is coming back a little bit. We're definitely not the bum's rush place. We're never going to rush you through service. We know that you're there for the experience and obviously the good food too, but we understand that there are some people that maybe can only, you know, attend us once a year or, you know, for special occasions, but we want, you know, that choice that our guests made to dine with us. We want them to fully enjoy the experience and the decision they made to join us and give them a true dining experience when they're with us.
Dessert-wise, any classic Ooh. Steakhouse desserts, bread pudding, chocolate cake, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we do. So we import our New York cheesecake from New York.
That would be the big one.
That'd be the big one.
Yeah.
We do have in-house bakers at both locations, though, that dabble in making cheesecakes and different things. In Fargo this weekend, we had banana bread pudding. And I can't even describe the ooey gooey goodness of that. It just melted in your mouth.
Bring some next time.
It was I should have because it's good for breakfast too. It was really good. And this, you know, obviously with Fargo being new, I didn't know that they were we didn't put them under pressure, you know, to get too creative right away, but the baker dove right in and came up with this, and I said, all right, let's roll with it. It was really good. And then to tag off on the sides one more time, we added a new side a couple months ago. Hal was in California, I think. I don't know if it was California or the East Coast, but he had a sweet potato side with a streusel on top. So Chef in Grand Forks went to work, and so we call it a sweet potato casserole, but it's a sweet potato blend with this brown sugar streusel on top of it, and then it's baked. It could be a dessert easily. You just put a big scoop of ice cream on that, and you could do some work with that.
Ice cream makes everything better. It really does.
It's really good.
And who is the head chef? We always like to talk about yep. that.
So the head chef is Lane Leach. She is a Grand Forks native. I actually worked with her at Ground Round in her younger days. We were both servers at Ground Round. And then she left to go to Colorado for family reasons. And then out in Colorado Springs is where she was culinary trained. And she worked at a French steakhouse in Colorado Springs for several years. And then life brought her back to Grand Forks in, I think, the early, 2012, 13, somewhere in there, I think. And lack of options for employment in Grand Forks brought her back to Ground Round as a prep cook. So she kind of... you know, Ground Round was a franchise. It was a chain, but it had some leeway with different things. But she came in and kind of recreated the French onion soup and some other different things there instead of buying, you know, the pre-processed bag stuff that most franchises use. So I invited it, and she did really well with it. And then she ended up moving on from Ground Round for better benefits and I think a different schedule, but unfortunately it just ended up at a nursing home in Grand Forks is where she ended up for a little while. But as soon as the conversation of Harry's Steakhouse came, I knew who I wanted to talk to, and I made a phone call to her, and we went out for coffee, and I explained to her what we wanted to do, and she jumped on board immediately, and it's just been a very fun trip.
Well, and as you've noticed, we like to have chefs on this show, mm-hmm. so I'll extend
we'll get her down, yeah.
invite
definitely.
Out to her. And we like to highlight female
yeah.
talent
yep.
in this community.
And because of her knowledge and just how well Grand Forks is running, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel in West Fargo. So we didn't hire a chef per se down here. We have more of a kitchen manager. And then Chef Lane will be down here, you know, once a week or as needed. And they will be collaborating monthly for the specials because we're going to run specials the same in both locations at the same time, just for ease, you know, and we don't want to confuse people. And oh, I had this in Fargo, or I had this in Grand Forks. And Jacob, our kitchen manager here in West Fargo, him and Lane get along really well, and they're excited to work together. And I think between the two of them, the collaboration is going to get elevated quite a bit, and it'll be interesting to see what they come up with.
Well, all good stuff. Matt Wallowak, thanks for coming in. Congratulations to Hal and Kathy Gershman.
Yep.
Great people.
They are.
Go check out Harry's Steakhouse in Grand Forks or West Fargo if you haven't yet. This is Rick Ian, your host of Prairie Plates. We'll talk to you next week.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, in partnership with the Good Relatives, announcing the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, Minneapolis American Indian Center, Makoche Agriculture Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. Learn more at goodrelativescollaborative.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 11th. The Pure Foods Movement was a grassroots effort that called attention to the presence of unhealthy additives in processed food. Prior to 1906, there was no governmental oversight of processed foods and pharmaceutical drugs. Purity, quality, and sanitation were not regulated. Upton Sinclair's 1906 novel, The Jungle, exposed the unsanitary conditions of Chicago slaughterhouses. The book increased people's awareness of the unhealthy condition of some foods. There are many examples of producers trying to maximize their profit by adulterating their products. Milk, for example, was often thinned with water. Dyes, chalk, or plaster dust were then added to enhance the color. In the days before refrigeration, a common additive to milk was formaldehyde as a preservative. One early champion of pure food and drugs was Professor Edwin F. Ladd, the chemistry instructor at the North Dakota Agricultural College. Professor Ladd was concerned that people were being poisoned by chalk dust, coal tar, toxic dyes, and other additives. One of Professor Ladd's targets was ketchup. Benzoate of soda was being added to ketchup. Producers claimed it was necessary to preserve ketchup after the bottle was opened. Ladd pointed out that producers of ketchup were known to add water to increase the volume of ketchup at very little cost. Ladd said that after a bottle of ketchup was opened, it increased the rate of spoilage. If the producers didn't add water, they would not need to add the benzoate of soda. A good reason to avoid the additive is that it can turn into benzene, a carcinogen, when mixed with vitamin C, which is plentiful in ketchup. Eventually, the use of clean factories allowed ketchup to be made from ripe tomatoes instead of fermented tomatoes, eliminating the need for benzoate of soda. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Bird Note. Isaiah Scott was in middle school when his family took him to visit the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. He remembers being blown away by a painting called The Wall of Birds.
It's this beautiful, huge mural with like the map of the world, but it had these colorful birds. And I was like, wow, I didn't know there was this many birds with different colors and different sizes and bill morphologies. And it just made me recognize the beautiful diversity of birds all around the world.
He marveled at the blue-footed booby in the Galapagos Islands, the osprey diving above the Florida Peninsula, and hundreds more life-size birds painted by artist Jane Kim.
From that point, I was like, I want to know more about birds. Like, I want to go out and see what birds that I find and how many of these birds on this wall that I could potentially see one day.
Isaiah bought his first pair of binoculars from the gift shop and started birding. Years later, he returned to Cornell to study ornithology and science communication as an undergrad. And now, Isaiah shares his love of birds on social media, guided hikes, and through his own artwork, thanks to that first spark.
Ever since then, I've just been pointing my eyes towards the skies with my binoculars.
You can learn more about Isaiah Scott and the Wall of Birds when you visit our website, birdnote.org. I'm Jonice Franklin.
A new report from Amnesty International documents, quote, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment at two Florida detention facilities, including what's better known as Alligator Alcatraz.
Ultimately, these two facilities need to be shut down, and the people inside need to be released into their home communities.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
I am Cole Maring, and I am from Fargo, North Dakota. I choose to be a Prairie Public Sustainer because of the myriad programs that they have that I find really valuable. Give me a more nuanced view of the world, introduce me to new great music. Oh, I think others should support Prairie Public for the same reason I do. These things don't just happen without us supporting them. Stuff that you're never going to hear, but you're going to love when you do hear it. Yeah, favorite programs and shows. I like to hear my Dakota Datebook every day. I really like Into the Music with Mike Olson. I liked the previously the Thomas Jefferson Hour with Clay Jenkinson. Just really, really great stuff. My favorite Prairie Public Radio personality, I would have to say, is Dave Thompson. I think that we just need to really do our best to appreciate it more and more.
You could be like Cole and become a sustaining member of Prairie Public today. It's easy. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the Donate tab.
And that wraps up this edition of Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll dive into the topic of who will lead North Dakota Supreme Court next, Justice Lisa Fair McEvers or Justice Jared Tufte, and how would each reshape the state's court system. We'll visit with Mary Stoyer from the North Dakota Monitor. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street. and we look forward to your joining us again.